nature and try to understand, okay, this is the law of motion, this is the law of thermodynamics. And for all practical purposes, science and nature, science and God have become divorced. So one of the upcoming books that I'm working on is called Science and God, The Divorce and Reunion. So today we will see historically why they got divorced and how they can be reunited. So the history of science. So this will be the three main topics. How the divorce of science and spirituality ruptured the human psyche. Human psyche means humanity's mind, humanity's heart. It is ruptured because both these are faculties of the human intellect, science and spirituality. So when they were divorced, it created a cleavage, a sharp rupture in the heart. And how India has a unique opportunity to bring about a synthesis and what ISKCON is doing about it. So if you look at the history of Western science, we can demarcate three distinct phases. They can be called as theism, deism and atheism. Have any of you heard the word deism? So theism is, most of us know, belief in God. But theism means belief in God as the creator and the controller of this world. God created the world and he controls the world. However, so this was the predominant belief in the East and the West before Newton. Now post-Newton, the scientists who came after him gained more and more in confidence, thinking that the laws of nature in themselves can explain the behavior of natural objects and we don't need to bring in any God. So the predominant scientific vision of the universe was what is called as the clockwork cosmos. Clockwork cosmos means just like I have a watch here, or we may have a clock here. Okay. Now a watch, the very fact that it is working systematically indicates that it was designed. It could not have come by chance. But now the creator of this watch, does he have any control on it now? No, he has created according to certain laws, certain mechanisms. We put a cell, there are certain electromagnetic components in it and they make the clock work. So that became the idea of the universe, that surely God created the universe, but now the universe is running according to laws. And there is no role for God now. So God, so theism is the idea that God is the creator. Is there a slide there for it? No. Oh God. Okay, sorry. So there's no slide over here. I have another PowerPoint. Okay, so God is the creator and the controller. That is theism. Deism is God is the creator but not the controller. And why? Because the world is working according to laws. That was the idea of science, that science had. And then subsequently, when Darwin came up with his theory of evolution, which purported or claimed to explain how the species originated, then mainstream science felt that there was no need for God as a creator also. So the predominant intellectual ethos started supporting atheism. And God is not even a creator, nor even a controller. So, that's what we encounter in mainstream science today. However, there is a flip side to this story. The flip side is that first of all, Darwin's theory is far from being proven. And that's why we have Newton's laws of motions, but we don't have Darwin's law of evolution. We have only Darwin's theory of evolution. Because there is no mathematical formulation of how the theory will work. So there are practically no evidences conclusively of one species evolving into another. Scientists are, even those who support evolution, are entirely divided whether we humans are the pinnacle of evolution or is evolution going to exceed us also. So, the normal scientific theory, we have to make some predictions. For example, if I drop a ball from here, then I can predict after how many moments it will reach the ground. Because the law of gravitation is scientifically verifiable and it is mathematically expressible. But in nature, there is no such thing about evolution.
There is no law. For example, if we keep a human being in a particular environment for 100 years, what changes will come in him, if any?
There's nobody who can predict that. So the Darwin's theory is not at all predictable. And whatever are taught of as proofs of evolution are actually not proofs of evolution. They are merely they are not proofs of the evolution of one species into another. They are merely demonstrations of the flexibility within species. There is, we will not talk about evolution here. If we get time, we'll have a separate session on that. But I'll just make 2 points here about evolution. You know, many times people think that the theory of evolution is scientifically proven because there is a confusion of two concepts. One is called microevolution and the other is macroevolution. So microevolution is variation within species. And macroevolution is variation across species, from one species to another. So an example of microevolution is that we can have a dog, and the dog species can manifest remarkable variety. We can have small poodles, we can have huge German shepherds, we can have ordinary street dogs, but they are all dogs. Nobody will mistake a dog to be an elephant. The dog is a dog. Similarly, by genetic mutation, we can have a grape instead of this normal size, we can have it this size. And we can have an apple of small size. But it's an apple. You know, we can't transform by genetic mutation apple into a mango. An apple is an apple. So, what can be done, not only by science, but even by nature, is microevolution. Microevolution is variation within species. But, you know, we can have, say, like the Jersey cows which are there in India, they are a crossbreed of two mammals. But we cannot crossbreed. Crossbreed means bring about a mating, a physical copulation between two species, between members of two species. We cannot have a crossbreeding between a cow and a tiger. Isn't it? Not just because the tiger will eat it, but because there is infertility. That's why even evolutionists acknowledge something which is called as a rubber band effect. Now if you take a rubber band, we pull it. And what happens after some time? Tuck, it breaks. And as soon as we let it go, it comes back to normal size. So like that, the evolution of species, Darwin's theory of evolution claims, that all the various life forms came about, that theory is faced with this insurmountable obstacle of the rubber band effect. When we try to bring about a variation in the species can vary slightly. But beyond a particular point, if we try to vary it, there's infertility. There's no reproduction and the variation stops. So, we can make a mango bigger or smaller, but we can't convert a mango into apple or a watermelon. You know, we have a rabbit, we can make a rabbit, maybe we can change the skin of it, its skin color, can change its size. But we can't make a rabbit into a tortoise or even any other species. So this is called the rubber band effect. And so now microevolution can happen through nature, microevolution can be brought about through science. But that does not lead to change of one species to another. It only leads to change within species. And what evolution requires is change across species. So, not even is there a single example of such a change taking place, whether we observe or whether we try to create in the laboratory. There is no observation of this at all, anywhere documented. And that creates a serious problem. If a theory, as I said, has no mathematical expression, it has no observable evidence, then what is left of the theory? Now, this is the two problems. There is no mathematical expression, there is no observable evidence. And an even more crippling problem is, there is no systematic mechanism to bring about evolution. Darwin had no idea about genes. because the whole branch of genetics was developed after him. So it started with Mendel towards the end of the 19th century and the earlier 20th century. Darwin wrote his book in 1859. And his idea was that the changes in this body of the living entity are accumulated and transmitted. That means, like a standard example is, there are so many mammals which have normal size necks. There are deer, there are antelopes, and suddenly there's a giraffe, which is such a long neck. So Darwin's theory was that, maybe certain four-legged grazers were living in an area where there was not sufficient grass available in the neighborhood. So they had to crane their necks, pull up. And then the giraffes with the longest necks, the he giraffe and the she giraffe, they mated. And the hey presto, their baby giraffe had a longer neck than them. And then, like that, it went on generation after generation. And then you have a giraffe with such a long neck. Now, have any of you seen the documentary which tells the problem about this? Maybe we will show you on this video later. But here I'll just tell theoretically itself. What is the problem with this? That even if a giraffe cranes its neck more and more and more, its necks become longer. That is just a change in its anatomical structure. And what is transmitted to its next generation is the genes. So by the stretching of the neck, are the genes changed? No. So because the genes are not changed, that supposedly prolonged neck will not be transmitted to the next generation. And this was like a crippling blow for evolution. I hope the problem is clear. The problem is that, because of survival of the fittest, certain features of a particular organism may be selected, and the organism with that feature may survive. But that feature is a physical feature because it helps him in the physical struggle for existence. But that special physical feature, which is developed in the struggle for the existence, does not lead to a change in the gene. And because it does not lead to a change in the gene, it will not go to its successor. Now, scientists have tried to come up with different theories. They say that there are genetic mutations by which certain changes may take place. But the mutations are basically accidents. Just like sometimes you will see some people, instead of having five fingers in their hand, they have six fingers. Well, that they say is because of some problem in the genetic mutation. Now, genetic mutations have never been observed to be beneficial. They are all harmful. And therefore, for them to bring about a change which is positive, and not just small positive, but so positive that an entirely new species comes up, is again straining credibility. It is not at all a scientific hypothesis. So, we'll discuss about this later, but in more detail. But suffice it to say that there is no mathematical expression, there is no observable evidence, there is no theoretical mechanism for evolution. And that's why there are a large number of scientists who themselves are opposing the theory of evolution. In fact, if you go on Google and search for Descent from Darwin, the whole website, where there are hundreds of scientists from all over the world, they say, and these are all PhD scholars and researchers in microbiology, they are saying, due to the scantiness of the evidence, we strongly oppose the teaching of evolution in colleges and universities. So anyway, historically, Darwin's theory was seen as proof that either there is no God or there is no need for God within nature. So what happened in this? So it put science and religion in conflict. And what happened in this conflict was, the winner was called as a school of thought known as naturalism. Now what is this naturalism? Naturalism means, as we have communism or socialism or capitalism, so this is naturalism. Naturalism is the study of nature. And what happened in this naturalism? Scientists started saying that, we will simply study nature. And we won't bother about if there is anything supernatural or not. Maybe there is a God, maybe there is a soul. We don't care about it. We want to say how nature works, and we will explain nature according to natural causes. we will not bring in any supernatural causes. So, anyway, this is a little technical. There are two terms called methodological naturalism. The scientists say that God may exist, but we won't bring God into the picture. Keep God outside science. Why? They say we are studying nature, stick to nature. God is supernatural. So we can't bring God into science. Now the problem with this theory is that actually there are many cases where we have to bring in where things cannot be explained according to natural causes. For example, there is a science, branch of science called forensics. Does anyone know what is forensics? What is it? In criminal investigation. So now, in forensics, suppose, you know, in a locked room, it is found that a knife wound has killed a person. Then now, scientists can just by researchers, whether they are the policemen or the investigators or whoever, just by seeing the pattern of the knife wound, they can make out whether this is a accidental hit of the piercing of the wound or it is an intentional stab. So that means if science were to stick, if we as human beings in search of knowledge were to stick only to natural causes, then we will, the whole field of forensics will become useless. Isn't it? Okay, why did WTC fall down? Oh, because the airplane crashed into it. But who was driving the airplane? No. We can't go into supernatural causes. We stick only to natural causes. The airplane caused it, finished. Investigation over. That would be ridiculous, isn't it? Why did 2611 attack on CST take place in Mumbai? Oh, because when a machine gun opened fire. See, you know, in our day-to-day life, we want to acquire knowledge. And when we want to acquire knowledge, as human beings, we should be open to knowledge from whichever sources it is comes. If we get valid wisdom from science, we accept it. If we can get valid wisdom from nature, we use that. But where natural explanations are inadequate, we need to turn elsewhere. So science is like a map. Now, a very well-known physicist called Geoff Capra, in his books, Tao of Physics, describes this analogy very systematically. A map is very useful for navigating territory. If, for example, from here, if you have to go to Calcutta and you are driving a vehicle, then if you have a map, okay, now I'll come to this bridge, I have to go across the bridge. Now I'll come to a two-way crossing, I have to go left. So a map can surely help us navigate territory. And without the map, navigating territory is difficult. But suppose if you are going to Mumbai for doing some research work and there you meet a professor, say Professor Chatterjee, and you have looked at the map and every turn, every crossing that you had to do with the map, it has guided you unreliably. And then when you reach the research lab in Calcutta, and then there is Professor Chatterjee, and the student looks at the map. He looks at the map and yes, Professor Chatterjee says, what can I do for you? According to my map, you don't exist. So Professor Chatterjee will say, your intelligence doesn't exist. So the idea is, a map is useful. But a map, by definition, cannot describe the totality of reality. Isn't it? A map, by definition, will describe certain aspects of reality. And now surely the map works. But just because the map works, is it valid to say that the map is the exclusive source of knowledge for us? No. You know, if in our map there is no Professor Chatterjee there, and if you are meeting Professor Chatterjee, then you say, okay, now the map has finished its role, and now let us talk with Professor Chatterjee using our normal conversations. So unfortunately, what happens with science is, so, like the map, you know, as science started studying nature, okay, people used to believe earlier that why are the planets moving? Oh, because some spirits are making them move. And we understand, actually it's not spirits who are making them move, it is gravity which is making them move. Of course, Newton himself recognized the problem with gravity. What was the problem? He said, if you ask them, you know, Kekule criticized him for that, and Newton said, I have no answer for this. What was the criticism? He said, okay, what is the why do planets move in their orbits? It's because of gravity. What is gravity? The force that causes planets to move in their orbits. Now, where is the explanation?
Isn't it?
Now, by naming an observed phenomena, do we explain the phenomena? Not really. So Kekule recognized this problem and he says, you are bringing occult means unscientific, mythological sort of things, occult phenomena into science. He criticized Newton. He said, you know, how do you say that through the space mysteriously some force is acting over thousands and thousands of miles from one body to another? So Newton said, I have no idea about how this force acts. All that I am giving is a mathematical formulation to explain observed phenomena. So I am giving a mathematical formulation, F is equal to G M1 M2 upon R square, that explains the observed phenomena. You take this equation and you can explain the motion of planets. Now how this happens, I don't know. Now Einstein came up and he came up with this idea of space-time. So now see how this is how science gets lost in one sense. What happened was, so how does gravity come from? There's no explanation. All that we know, okay, this is the formula by which we can understand what is gravity. But what is gravity actually? Is it really a force? How does that force get transmitted? So Newton had no explanation, and there was no explanation until Einstein came up. So Einstein came up with the idea that of something called space-time. So he says space-time, so three dimensions of length, mass, breadth, length, width and breadth, combined with time, form a continuum called space-time. And he says whenever there is a heavy object, then space-time gets curved. And because of the curvature of space-time, something called as gravity is created. So actually there is no force called gravity, there is simply the curvature of space-time. So now this seems to be an interesting explanation, but there is a problem here. The problem is, originally the purpose of science was to explain observed phenomena. Okay, like Newton observed, tack, this fruit fell, why did it fall? Okay, we see an observation, and to explain the observation is the business of science. And to explain the observation, science proposes certain concepts. So for example, to explain why a fruit falls, which is the concept that is proposed? Gravity. Okay, now, but the problem is gravity itself needs an explanation. So then to explain gravity, another concept is proposed, that is space-time. So then what is happening? Now gravity itself is not tangible. We can't touch gravity, we can't see gravity. Space-time is even more intangible. So what happens in science is that there is free creation of concepts. You know, if to explain one observation, we create one concept. To explain that concept, you create another concept. And like that, you keep piling concepts. Eventually, you just have concepts, and there is practically the concepts are alienated from the actuality of reality. So now, currently, according to science, as we have it developed today, either we go to quantum physics or through relativity, the world that comes from science has no correlation with the world as we experience it. Now, for example, this color is red. It is. Is a blend of yellow and red, which is called as saffron. So now, what gives this cloth its particular color? Now, if we go down scientifically, you know, ultimately this matter is made up of atoms and molecules. That matter is made of atoms and molecules, and basically the atoms comprise of electrons which are revolving around a nucleus. And ultimately, if we go further, then we have mesons and so many other particles, neutrinos and all those things. But if we look at it upward, now electrons themselves don't have any color, they don't have any taste. Now, the electrons, when they come together and they form an atom, the atom, does it have any taste? There's a thought experiment, and if you take a salt crystal, a small crystal, okay, then you break it in small parts, then will it still have a taste? Okay, it has a taste. But you break it in a smaller part. Smaller part, further smaller part. Then what happens? Does it still have a taste of salt? We can say, yeah, it may have a taste, but my tongue cannot taste that taste. Okay, yeah, granted. But still the problem remains, And if we go down to the salt atom, a salt molecule, okay, and the salt molecule is made of atoms. So now, atoms which are made of electrons and nucleus don't have any taste or color or smell or softness or anything like that. So how does that scientific world lead to our real world? That is what scientists call an eerie chasm. You know, chasm is like a river between two mountains. A valley with a river, with an eerie chasm. There is a huge valley between the world that is built by science and the world that is experienced by us. I think there will be a quote here by Schrodinger, another scientist, which I quoted in my book Science and Spirituality, about how science fails to explain the world as we know it. Why does it not explain? Because now we are not even brought God in till now. We are simply talking about matter. Now, for example, you know, many of you may be learning musical instruments during this workshop, and some of you may be learning singing. Now, if you look at singing, you know, if somebody is a very good singer, now if we scientifically start observing the voice chords of that person, do you think the voice chords will be any different? Are the voice chords of a genius singer made of some special components which the ordinary person's voice chords are not made up of? No, you may say they have a little more stamina, they have a little more capacity to produce different pitch and things like that. That's okay, but where does the difference come from? So, the point here I'm making is, even material reality cannot be explained by science completely. If we stick just to the naturalistic way of life, so the color, where does the color come from? Where does the fragrance come from? The electrons don't have any color, they don't have any fragrance, they don't have any taste. But our world has this. So how does that world of science relate with the world that we experience every day? Yes, we'll have question answers time. So basically, what happened was, naturalism is like a map. And a map is useful for navigating the territory. So like that, physics as we know it is useful. It is remarkably useful for us for developing technology. And we are showing this projector, so obviously technology works. But the mistake is to think that because something works, it is absolutely and always true. The mistake is to think that if a map works, that whatever the map shows me is the reality and there is no other reality beyond that. That is the mistake. So science works, and where science has worked, there is reason to give due credit to science. But the problem is, there is a school of thought called, another word for naturalism is called as scientism. Scientism means science is the only source of knowledge, and what cannot be explained by science does not exist. That's the idea. Now that is a serious blunder. That is a serious blunder. Let's move forward. So now here we'll talk about how science originally was highly theistic. So there are many quotes of eminent scientists. Can we have one devotee reading them? Who would like to read? Yes, please.
We ought to value the privilege of knowing God's truth far beyond anything we can have in this world. Michael Faraday.
Yes. So what did Faraday develop? Electromagnetism. So now he said, yes, we developed this, but there is something far more important to know. The privilege of knowing God's truth. What is God's purpose in creating this world? That is far more important for us to know. This is India's own mathematical genius. Yeah, who would like to read? Yes, please.
Equation for me has no meaning unless it represents a thought of God.
What a thought, isn't it? Now we have studied E is equal to mc square, F is equal to gm and m2 upon r square. But who made this equality? That is a thought of God. Remember I said, Newton said, O God, I think thy thoughts after thee. So an equation, how did it become equal? That is a thought of God. Now these are all modern scientists. The Nobel laureate in physics, Arthur Compton. Yes, please.
An orderly, intelligent universe testifies to the greatest statement ever uttered: in the beginning, God.
In the beginning, God. That means science does not disprove God. Science actually proves God. Yes, who would like to read? Yes, please. Ernst Borgstein is a Nobel Prize in. What is his work with penicillin?
The
The principle of divine purpose stares the biologist in the face wherever he looks. The probability for such an event as the origin of DNA molecule to have occurred by sheer chance is just too small to be seriously considered.
Yes. So, the study of the DNA has actually problematized naturalism. Why problematized naturalism? You remember what is naturalism? That everything works according to nature's laws and we don't need any factor other than nature. So, DNA is basically like many of you may have heard of the genome project, human genome project. So, basically scientists are trying to codify. So, DNA has this adenine, guanine, thymine, cytosine. So, it's basically like an alphabet. And the alphabet contains the program according to which the different organs of our body grow and our entire body also grows. Now, even if we are able to unravel and understand the program, still the question remains, where did the program come from? Who wrote the program? Isn't it? The sheer complexity of the program. The Human Genome Project was developed by something like several hundred scientists working for more than 2 decades and just writing down the program on paper. You know, that means the whole arrangement of ADCT in the human DNA, it would pile up papers something like 700 feet. Nobody has done writing it like that, it's all stored in the computer. But minimum, huge height of papers would be piled up. So, now we have two problems. Who wrote the program? Such a complicated program cannot come by chance. And secondly, even if we agree that God wrote the program, God's role doesn't end over there. Because even if we write a very, very systematic program, after that, we need a maintainer for the program. Programs implementation. Many of you become software engineers. And one of the jobs that software engineers has to do is maintenance. No matter how well we design a program, there are always bugs. And because computer programs have bugs, programmers have jobs. Imagine if today onwards, the programs were written in such a way that they would never have any bugs. You know, most programmers would go out of jobs. So no matter how well a program is written, it may not be a problem with the program, it's a problem with the circumstance. As the circumstances change, the program starts malfunctioning. There are eventualities which are not anticipated. So no matter how sophisticated a program, we need a maintainer. That's why I say the principle of divine purpose stares the biologist in the face. There are many more quotes. This is Max Born. Yes, who would like to read? Yeah.
Those who say that the study of science makes a man an atheist must be rather silly people.
Silly people is a strong word he's using. So he is a Nobel laureate in quantum mechanics. Now here is Derek Barton. So another Nobel laureate in chemistry. Yes.
There is no incompatibility between science and religion. Science shows that God exists.
Yes, very clear. Categorical. There are many quotes, we'll just take a few more. It's Christian Anfinsen. So what does he say? Yes? So he's making a value judgment, but that's based on his research. He's a Nobel laureate in chemistry again. And there's Albert Einstein. Yes?
I only trace the lines that follow from God.
Yes, lines that flow from God. What does that mean? That means we can see the patterns and we try to connect the patterns. Like there are dots and you have to solve some riddles to connect the dots. So basically now, this is just a small sample. In my book, Science and Spirituality, I've given almost like 30-40 eminent scientists and all founders of branches of science, not just mediocre scientists. And here also the scientists we have quoted are all Nobel laureates. So they are all believing in God. So now if naturalism were true in its entirety, all these scientists would be wrong. So currently, why don't we learn about God in our textbooks at all when we study science? It is because of naturalism. But naturalism itself is inadequate. So have any of you seen this slide before? Okay, so what does it demonstrate? If you use a Mercedes for plowing, what is going to happen? 3 things will happen. The Mercedes will get spoiled, the field will get spoiled, the driver will get frustrated. So, Actually, the human intelligence, we certainly have a higher human intelligence because of which we are able to do scientific inquiry. This human intelligence is meant to probe the ultimate mysteries of life. The ultimate mysteries of life lead us to spirituality. When we keep the human intelligence locked within nature, locked within matter, the result of that is that it backfires. That human intelligence, just like a Mercedes, is meant to drive on a smooth road and not to plow a field. The human intelligence is meant to probe the deepest mysteries of life and universe and lead wherever the research, wherever the study takes one. But when we lock up the intelligence within nature, within matter, the result is materialism. And when human beings live materialistically, that is like using a Mercedes for plowing. So what happens? The human body gets spoiled. That's like the Mercedes getting spoiled. You take any material enjoyment, what is the result? It spoils the human body. People have illicit sex, it leads to AIDS and so many other diseases. People smoke, it leads to lung cancers. People drink, it leads to liver problems. Just if people overeat, it leads to so much obesity. In America, now the single largest cause of avoidable death is obesity. Single largest cause of avoidable death. So, I wrote an article for Economic Times called Fatal Fat. So they reported how there was a lady in Mumbai, you know, she had not come out of her house for 6 years. Why? Because her body is too big to fit through a door of the house. So according to UNESCO WHO statistics, there are 800 million people in the world who are undernourished. But there are 1,000 million, that means 1 million people who are obese. So you take any enjoyment. Now, overeating seems to be an innocent form of enjoyment, harmless. But it's not only harming us, it's harming others. Because we were depriving them of their food. So now of course, there might be a little obesity, that is not a serious problem. But the principle we are trying to understand over here. The obesity might also have some genetic causes. There are different factors. But the principle is that any material enjoyment we try, that harms our body. That's like the Mercedes getting spoiled by plowing. Not only that, we harm the environment. Now, there's so much talk about climate change. Now, if you see, it's not the tigers or the elephants in the savanna deserts or in the Amazon forest that are causing climate change. Nor are the tribals, tigers or tribals or whoever. They're not causing. It's the modern man and the modern woman who by their lifestyle are causing climate change. So threatening the environment in irrecoverably and irreversibly damaging ways. And what happens to the driver? You know, despite living materialistically, you know, according to global trend statistics, America has the population of the world which is only 4.6% of the world. But Americans consume more than 33% of the world's resources. So, you know, when Gandhi was asked by Britain that when British government was leaving India, he said that, is India going to follow the British model of development? So he says, to feed the development of one Britain, it required one country as large as India and so many other countries in the British colonies. So he said, if India were to follow the British model, several earths would be inadequate. So, you know, it is not only unsustainable, that we can't have 5% of the world's people consume 33% of the world's resources, but more than that, in spite of such consumption, are Americans happy? You know, according to statistics, which is the single largest drug that Americans take? It's antidepressant pills. Single largest drug. It's not cancer, it's not AIDS, it's not any other disease. It's antidepressant pills are the single biggest pharmaceutical industry in America. So what does it indicate? Why do people have to take antidepressant pills? Because they are not happy. So, you see what is happening? Actually, we are consuming the world's resources. That means it's like spoiling the field. But after spoiling the field also, we are ourselves not happy. And of course, the strongest evidence that people are not, humans are not happy is that humans have the dubious distinction of being practically the only species that commits suicide. I said, do you see a dog on the street committing suicide? No. You know, my brother is studying in Michigan now. So he was telling me that in most universities, if the university building is more than four stories, in most colleges, they have security nets around the building. Mandatory structural requirement. Why? Because so many people commit suicide. Srila Prabhupada, when he went to America, he said, you know, what is the progress of you Americans? You build big, big buildings, then climb on top of them, jump down and commit suicide. So, our point here is that materialism doesn't lead to satisfaction of the heart. So, therefore, why are we talking about materialism and science? Actually, science, the way it is taught today, makes people materialistic. Because science makes people think that there is no God, or at least there is no need for God. You know, we can live materialistically and enjoy, but materialism doesn't lead to happiness. So, the result of naturalism is that people suffer. So, our bodily health suffers, the environment suffers, and we become mentally frustrated. Now, interestingly, science requires tangible evidence. So there was this Handbook of Religion and Health published by Oxford University Press, where they studied, these three researchers, Koenig, McElroy and Larson, they reviewed 2000 published experiments that tested the relationship between religion and physical health and religion and mental health. So physical health included parameters like blood pressure, heart disease, cancer and stroke. And mental health included parameters like depression, suicide, psychotic disorders, and marital problems. So now, that means in different journals all over the world, these research were published. And they compiled and reviewed them. And what was their finding? Their finding was that people who attended a spiritual program at least once a week, they lived on average 7 years longer than those who didn't attend at all. Can you imagine? So just by coming for the weekly voice program, you are increasing your life by 7 years. And it's not that we are saying it, scientists are saying this, it's a scientific finding. And they found that younger people showed lower levels of drug and alcohol abuse, premature sexual involvement, criminal delinquency and suicidal tendencies than the non-religious counterparts. So first is the quantity of life improves, the quality of life for young people improves. What about the quality of life for elderly people? Those who had deep religious personal faith, they have a stronger sense of well-being and life satisfaction than their non-religious peers. So what was their conclusion? A high SQ faithfulness to God appears to benefit people of all means, educational levels and ages. So if science wants tangible evidence, here is tangible evidence that belief in God can bring about materially beneficial results. That's why, what did Max Planck say? Who would like to read this loudly and clearly? Yes, please. Yes, that means after 200 years of exhaustive research from the time of Darwin and before, the science say there's no God, there's no God. Then after their research, what are they coming to? Yes, there is God. In the Bhagavad Gita, in the 70th chapter 19th verse, Lord Krishna says, Bahunam janmanam ante jnanavan maam prapadyate. So after many lifetimes, when a person becomes jnanavan, intelligent, he surrenders to. That is what science is coming to the conclusion. So Donald Knuth is a computer scientist. What does he say? Science is what we understand well enough to explain to a computer. Art is everything else we do. So where science falls short? Now why does science fall short? As I said, if say we are depressed by something and then we go home and there our mother consoles us or some loud one consoles us, we feel encouraged, they comfort us. Now, if we have a computer with automated program, cool down, everything will be all right. It's fine, don't worry. Do you think that's going to work? No, because the computer, it can just replicate the words. But there are no emotions, there is no heart in it. So you know, there are several famous researchers who have done research in this, that emotions don't originate from the brain. They may be rooted through the brain. Dr. Wilder Pinfield was a Canadian neurosurgeon. He's called the father of neurosurgery. And he started out, he said, I'll disprove this whole religious belief in soul. That was his idea. And then he started off his research. So he developed, by his study, he found out that, you know, if you put electrodes in the brain, and say, for example, if you put an electrode in the parietal lobe, then that will trigger the motor nervous system. So you put an electrode and trigger it, then the hand goes up. So he asked the subject, what happened? He says, my hand went up. Did you raise your hand? No, I didn't raise your hand. Raise my hand. You raised it. Okay. Then he deactivated. The hand falls. What happened? He says, my hand went down. Did you put it down? Said, no, I didn't. You put it down. Okay. Then now he stops the electrode. He says, now raise your hand. He raises the hand. The same part of the brain gets activated and you can observe it through the particular sensors. This is what happened. He said, I raised my hand. Sure? Yes, of course, I raised my hand. Then zoom. Okay, now put your hand down. Put the hand down. And what happened? He says, yes, I put my hand down. And he found that that part of the brain is deactivated. So this seems a simple experiment, but Dr. Penfield realized that this has grave implications. What is that? The brain is basically like a control center for the body. Now, when certain signals are put in the brain, the body responds accordingly. Now, in the first case, it was Dr. Penfield who was controlling and triggering the control center. And that's why the hand was moving. And the person, the subject, was saying, I'm observing it, but I'm not doing it. In the second case, the person was saying, I was doing it. So, just as now, so try to visualize, here is the brain, here is the hand. In the first case, Dr. Penfield, the external agent, is activating the hand through the brain. In the second case, who is activating it? That means the person is different from the brain. So what eventually he decided, let me find out more clearly. So he decided to do a third experiment. He said, okay, now what will you do? Now you should make sure that your hand does not rise up. Hold his hand down. And then what he would do is trigger the brain so that the right hand moves. And what happened? Zup! It was just going on. Now you can clearly see when the same thing happens that there are two agents involved. There is the external agent, there is Dr. Penfield, who is making the hand move up. And there is the person himself who is making the hand move down. That means, so his conclusion at the end of almost 40 years of study was that the brain is like a computer. But the programmer is outside the brain. It's like if I have a printer, now this computer belongs to me. So normally, I'll press the button and then the printer hand will start moving. Now suppose somebody ties up my hands and then he presses the printer. Tuck, and the printer hand starts moving. So somebody asks, what happened? The printer hand is moving. Did you cause it too? No, I didn't. You did. So something like that. But the person is different from the brain. So therefore, the person and his emotions cannot be understood by, cannot be explained by science. So Robert Sperry is another Nobel laureate brain scientist. So he gives another example, very interesting example. There are several scientists who have done like this. So Dr. Eccles is also another. So he says, imagine if somebody observes a car moving. Car in the garage and it starts moving. So then I start, why did the car start moving? Oh, the car started moving because the wheels are moving. Oh, because why are the wheels moving? Oh, because the axle mechanism created the pressure. Okay, but why did it, that pressure come? Oh, because there was a spark in the ignition in the engine. Oh, but why was there a spark in the ignition there? Oh, because the key was in the vertical position, the key moved to the horizontal position. Yes, now we know why the car moves. Because the key moved from the vertical to the horizontal position. Now, is this explanation correct? Yes, it is correct. But is it complete? No, it is pathetically incomplete. Isn't it? There's a person who decided to go out for a ride. And that's why he came in and he moved the key from the vertical to the horizontal. So like that, scientists will try to observe. Okay, why does hand go up? Oh, the hand went up because you know there are certain nerves which caused it to change, their positions change, and that's the muscles and the nerves, they cause the hand to. But why did that happen? Oh, that's because certain signals came in the nervous system. Why did that happen? Oh, because you know the parietal lobe in the brain was activated. Why was that activated? Oh, because you know certain signals came over here. The signals were not there, signals came here, and that's why the hand went up. Yes, now we got the explanation. No, that is not the explanation. That is a very incomplete explanation. It is correct as far as it goes. Again, remember the example of a map. A map is useful, but a map does not describe the territory. So, that's why it's where science falls short. So, Karl Popper is a philosopher of science. He says, science may be described as the art of systematic oversimplification. Why oversimplification? Because in order to study, science selects certain parameters. Now, for example, you know, if you just want to study this room, we can have so many parameters to study. We can study the, you know, the atmospheric air content. We can study the temperature variations, and we can find, you know, which person's bodies are more hot because of the temperature that is becoming hot. I'm sure here becoming less there. We can study what is the weight bearing capacity of each pole. We can study what is the waterbed below the earth at this particular point. We can study how are the acoustics of this room in different parts. There are literally millions of parameters which you can study for this one room. So science selects certain parameters for study. And in the process of selecting certain parameters, it neglects certain parameters. And that which is neglected is actually the foundation for human experience. Now, why is it the foundation for human experience? Because, for example, when a child sees the mother, the child feels a spontaneous love for the mother. He goes and, you know, embraces her lap, and the mother picks him up and puts him on her shoulder, and they embrace him rightly. Now, if we look at it clearly from a scientific perspective, you can say, what happened? Oh, certain chemicals were secreted in the brain of the mother and certain chemicals were secreted in the brain of the child. Now, yeah, that is true, but does that explain? Does that explain the situation? You know, even a scientist who proposes like this, you know, if he goes home and his wife is upset, will he tell her, I want to do a brain scan to find out why you are upset? You know, which chemicals have increased your brain? Says, you know, the wife will say, I will show you which chemicals have increased. She'll give him a slap in the face. So now, it is true that yeah, certain chemicals may be increased. But that is only the result, that is not the cause. See, this is the mistake of science, that which is the result, it thinks to be the cause. Just like, now when I spoke something, all of you laughed. Now, we can say that, is laughter the cause of happiness, is laughter the result of happiness? Generally, laughter is the result of happiness. Now, if we start saying, no, laughter is the cause of happiness, then what we could do is, we can all create face-twisting machines, so that all of us can always be laughing. Now, will all of us be happy? No. Or for that matter, even if you say, you know, actually, laughter is a biological phenomenon. So what, sometimes small children, if you tickle them, they start laughing, isn't it? You see, all children, sometimes relatives play with the game. They tickle. Start laughing. Now, he's laughing. Biologically, all the symptoms of laughter are there. But is he really happy? You know, if you are really happy, and if happiness is the goal of life, then all of us could have perpetual tickling machines. And all of us can keep tickling ourselves for the rest of life. And we'll all be happy. It doesn't work. So, to reduce emotional phenomena to their physiological or biological counterparts is a ridiculous reduction of reality to absurdity. So they are related, no doubt. If I want to do a scientific research, when I laugh, I can find out, you know, which muscles are activated in which way, by which my upper jaw goes up, lower jaw goes down, and what is the speed at which they keep going up and down. I can do a PhD in that also. But that misses the point. So, again, the point here is that science is useful as a map, but to mistake the map to be the reality creates the problem. So, when the mother feels the love for the child, when we live in a material body, all emotions will be expressed and experienced through the medium of material components. So certain biochemical phenomena will be associated with every emotion. But that doesn't mean that the emotion is reduced to that biochemical phenomena. The emotion is at the root. And the biochemical phenomena are the result. So that's why over-systematic simplification. Now why does science have to reduce? Because happiness, distress, fear, anticipation, all these are beyond the gross materialistic reach of science. Science studies only gross matter. Gross matter means earth, water, fire, air and their combinations. So now, in this, we don't find emotions, we don't find the mind. Therefore, okay, we don't bother about it. All that exists is gross matter. But then we can't explain reality completely. So that's what George Epoch says. All models are wrong, but some are useful. That means when science comes up with different models, they're models, like maps. Now why are all maps wrong? Because no map describes complete reality. Sometimes we have some diaries, so you will see some diaries, physical map of India, political map of India, transportation map of India. Isn't it? Now all of them are describing the same thing, but they're focusing on different features. And none of the maps is India. Isn't it? In that sense, all maps are wrong. You cannot have a map describe India in its totality. But partially it's okay, it describes. So Albert Einstein himself said, science is a wonderful thing if one does not have to earn one's living at it. Because once you have to start earning one's living, then, like my friend, about 10 years ago when he had to do his PhD. So he was getting stipend at that time in Pune, in various universities connected to Pune, 2000, 2500, 3000. And one project offered him 10,000 stipend. Surprised that time 10,000 was a huge stipend. So he asked, you know, why this stipend so much for this project? So that project was in statistical mechanics. He said, this project is sponsored by the luxury soap Lux. He said, acha, what is their purpose? He said, they have found that when they make luxury soaps, so at that time, if the foam is created and the foam tickles down the body, and these wealthy people who use this luxury soap, they like that tickling sensation very much. So we are funding this research so that you can find out ways by which you can increase the longevity of the water bubble, by which the foam's life can be increased. So then he thought, you know, I spent 6 years of my study to give a tickling to some wealthy people. So, now surely this is an extreme example, but it is true that much of science has now become sort of servant to serve the needs of wealthy people. And that's why, even if you read core science books, many scientists write the death of physics, the end of science. Last almost 80-90 years, there have been no major breakthroughs in the understanding of nature. There have been remarkable breakthroughs in technology. You know, we have laptops, we have palm tops, we have cell phones with cameras, we have cell phones with internet. And this is technology, which is wonderful. But technology is not understanding of nature. Technology is only manipulation of nature. So, when one has to earn one's living, then what happens is one starts seeing where one can get a living, one's living, and the core subjects of study get neglected. So that's why Martin Luther King said, we live in an age of guided missiles and misguided men. Why guided missiles? Because science has, through technology, enabled us to guide missiles precisely. But because we have neglected the mind, we are not able to guide human beings. And we have misguided men. So the dark face of science, we see explosions, weapons of mass destruction, we see huge amount of pollution, we see loss of biodiversity. So now, scientific knowledge is surely increasing, but let's now carefully observe this slide. Let's see how it is increasing. So, it is surely increasing, but the increase is unidimensional. You notice it was increasing only vertically, it is not increasing horizontally. So, science is increasing its knowledge only in one direction, that of gross matter. But the broader understanding of reality is not increasing. What does that mean? Not only that, so God is outside the reality, outside this reach, always stays outside the reach. And it is porous. Porous means there are lots of holes in it. What are the holes? there is much in within science also that they cannot explain. For example, there is Gordon's theorem, which I won't go into technically, but it is a very serious problem, theoretical problem, which explains that science can never know anything for certain. Like Einstein said that, the more a theory is mathematically accurate, the less it will describe reality. And the more it describes reality, the less it will be mathematically accurate. So it's a paradox. These are all technical things. But basically, science is based on assumptions and axioms. There are many assumptions in science. And these assumptions means what? A-S-S-U-M-E. So when we assume, we make an ass out of you and me. So especially when we take the assumptions to be absolute truths and the resulting knowledge to be an absolute truth. So it's imperfect. These are three questions which science does not answer. Value of existence, purpose and questions about existence, purpose and value. Where did we come from? Why do all of us exist rather than nothing existing? Science has no answer to this. The question about origins. Purpose. Purpose means, why do I exist? What is the purpose of life? Science has no answer to that. And value. What is right? What is wrong? Science itself cannot tell. You know, if we just go by strictly scientific perspective, you know, when either Bin Laden blows up WTC or Kassab kills hundreds of people in Mumbai, you know, you cannot say that it is wrong. Because science does not give any moral judgments. Science is by definition amoral. Amoral means it does not talk about morality also at all. It will give the machines to people, but it will not tell this is right, this is wrong. So therefore, science does not tell us anything about these things. And that's why spirituality can exist, coexist, complement and reinforce each other. That's why Einstein already said ethical axioms. Ethical axioms means the truths of life, which are talking about spirituality, are found and tested not very differently from the axioms of life, or science. Truth is what stands the test of experience. So this is a long slideshow. I'll complete these 2 points now. And we'll have some question answers. We may continue this tomorrow if there are a lot of question answers. So spirituality is also a science. Now how is it a science? In science there are two aspects. There is theory and experiment. Similarly in spirituality there are two aspects. There is philosophy and religion. So now, just as theory tells, the theory of gravity, what does it say? Oh, actually, every particle of matter attracts every other particle of matter by a force that is directly proportional to the mass, then inversely proportional to the square of that distance. This is a theory. When we do an experiment, then it becomes a law. And the experiment is proven, it becomes a law. So like that, philosophy tells us, you are not the body, you are the soul. And religion offers us the practical methodologies by which we can verify it. So, philosophy will tell us, you are not the body of the soul. Religion will tell us, chant Hare Krishna. By that you can experience non-material fulfillment. You can experience a deep happiness. And when we experience that, we understand, yes, there is some truth to this. So in this way, spirituality itself is a science. And, as you know, Srila Prabhupada said, philosophy without religion is just mental speculation. That means if somebody just analyzes, okay, this person says like this, this person says this. Some people, you know, they sit on the sofa in the armchair on Sunday afternoon and they think, maybe God exists. There's so much design in this world. And then they look at the news. 3,000 people killed in an earthquake in Kashmir. There's so much evil in this world. God doesn't exist. There's no God. Anyway, the pleasure in this wine exists. Let me drink. So, if there is no practice, there will be no realization. Philosophy without religion is just mental speculation. And then, religion without philosophy is at best sentimentalism, at worst fanaticism. So, if you just have religion, do this, do that. Why? Oh, because it's good to do it. And some people say, my religion, kill all those people. The more people you kill, the more God will reward you. What is this perversity? But then it becomes fanaticism because there is no philosophy over there, no systematic philosophy. So now, This is a long slideshow. Maybe we'll continue this tomorrow. I'll summarize till now what I discussed. Tomorrow we'll be discussing about how this philosophy and religion join together. But today I discussed four main points. First, I discussed the history of science, where we talked about how science started with theism pre-Newton. Then from post-Newton to pre-Darwin, it was deism. God is the creator but not the controller. And post-Newton, post-Darwin, it was atheism, that God is not required either as the creator or as the controller. Then the elaborate point we discussed was naturalism and its problems. So naturalism means science will study only nature. But when we discussed the problems with this, one example is forensics. You know, science has to look at non-natural causes when there is a fatal wound in the stomach of somebody. If it is to make any progress in studying crime. So similarly, we discussed how science is like a map. And a map is useful as far as it goes, but it becomes blunderous when it is considered to be the totality of reality. So we discussed how eminent scientists, we discussed quotes from Max Planck to Einstein to Derek Barton and many others who talk about the need for God to explain the observable universe. So then we discussed about the soul and how the brain and its structure cannot explain emotions and cannot explain consciousness. So we discussed the inadequacies of naturalism. It is useful as a map, but it is inadequate as an explanation of the totality of reality. And then we discussed the flip side. If naturalism is itself considered the truth, then, like the Mercedes used for plowing, humans become materialistic and it harms their bodies, it harms their environment, and it frustrates them themselves. So materialism itself will lead to weapons of mass destruction, and that brings the really flip side of science. So we discussed the limitation of naturalism from a theoretical point of view and a practical point of view. And then we concluded by discussing about how spirituality is a higher dimensional science. And it has these two limbs of philosophy and religion. Now, how they blend together, that we will discuss in a future class. Any questions about what we discussed today? Yes, please. Do we have another mic? You can speak loudly till the mic gets set up. Question is, why do we exist? So, now, spirituality describes it's not that God created us. We are all eternal. God is eternal and we are also eternal. So when we say God is the creator, he's the creator of our material bodies. He's the creator of the material world. But God did not create us. We are all eternal. And what is the purpose of existence? The purpose of existence is happiness. Is happiness through love. So God loves us and we love him. And in his eternal abode, this loving reciprocation leads to the ultimate happiness. So love and the happiness thereof are the purpose of creation. And that is the purpose why we exist. Okay. Any other questions? Yes. Yeah, we'll come to you next.
I want to ask you to, if we see around our world, then everything is gone by some law or formula. Like between two bodies, the gravitation is a formula. If we try to slide a box on the ground, there's a formula of friction. Water is flowing, there's a formula of viscosity. If you see that, then everything has some
formula. There are millions and trillions of formula will be there. So why Lord made there is so much complication? For everything there is a formula, there is a setup. And he could have made the world in a
very, very simplified manner. But for every small setup,
there is a formula, there is a law.
That.
Okay, it's a good question. Why did God make the world in such a way that there are formulas governing everything? As it is said, these formulas are the fingerprints of God in this world. So, how do we develop faith in God's existence? By seeing how this world is superbly organized. So, actually God is giving us telltale evidence. For those who want to believe, then there is evidence for him. For those who don't want to believe, they will see this formula explain everything. But the formula don't explain everything, because they still keep the question unanswered of their own origin. So the formula, as we said, Ramanujan discussing, that it originates in the thought of God. So the organization of this world is the evidence of the intelligence of God. In the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna describes that yadyad vibhuti matsattvam shrimadurjitam evava tatta devahavagachattvam tejo amsha sambhava. He says in the 10th chapter, 41st verse in the Bhagavad Gita that know that all opulent, beautiful and glorious creations spring from but a spark of my splendor. So even the scientific laws and principles that govern this world spring from the splendor of God's intelligence. And they are there for us to observe, understand, and to deepen our appreciation of the supreme and marvelous intelligence of God. Okay. Yes, please.
We are talking about there are very few explanations of that science has for a lot of phenomena that we see. But what we can also say, if we look at religion also, there's a lot of things that we cannot justify experimentally. For example, even if there is a God, there's so much uncertainty in the world, so we understand that there must be some sort of force there. Even if we know there is this kind of God, how do we know the nature of that God? Is it according to what we Hindus believe? Or is it according to what... Is something totally different, something more higher than we could ever imagine? So, there is no way... He's not a chemical, something compound or something. We can explain in any way. So, what is he?
Good question. So, I rephrase the question. That yes, there are things in science which cannot be explained, but okay, even in religion, the nature of God cannot be scientifically verified to some extent. Yes, it is true, and that's why there are two kinds of theology. There is a rational theology and there is a revelational theology. A rational theology means the study of God according to our rationality, according to our intelligence. So now we can see by rational theology, okay, you can see so much design in this world. Now our own body, the eye, it is so intricate in its design. The digestive system, some scientists decided to do, many people have digestive problems nowadays, so they thought that, let us make a digestive machine and put it inside the stomach. Those people who have that problem, just like if you have a problem for the eyes, you can put an artificial cornea, you can put an artificial limb if somebody's hand is damaged. Let's try to put an artificial stomach. When they decided to do that, they found that one machine would not suffice. It would require a factory. Because the whole alimentary canal is so complicated and so intricate. And there is a factory would also not be enough. They will need a factory, chain of factory that would extend over 2 miles. And they dropped the idea afterwards. So the point is that even by rational, so their conclusion of the scientists currently is that if you consider W is equal to Fs, work is force into displacement, the amount of work that is required to digest one morsel of food when we eat it is far greater than the amount of work that an average human being performs throughout the day. So who is doing that? Aham vaishvanaro bhutva praninam deham ashitaha pranapana samayuktaha pachamyannam chaturvidham. In the 15th chapter, 14th verse of the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says that it is I who am the digestive fire and who digest and nourish the living beings, digest their food and nourish them. So, by rational theology, we can come to the conclusion that there is a God who is benevolent and who is very intelligent. But by rationality, we cannot come to a conclusive understanding. For example, Darwin argued with his Christian peers, he said, you see the God is so kind, I don't see any kindness of God. I see that when a tiger attacks a deer, the tiger feasts on the body of the trembling deer with a bestial delight. And where is any compassion there in nature? There is simply brutality. I don't see any kindness of God in nature. So this was his argument. Now is it true? You may say, if God is there, why are there so many natural calamities, so many disasters? So, if we just stick to rationality, sometimes we feel there is very good design, other times we will feel, oh, there is no design, there is chaos. Or there is not design, there is cruel design. You know, God has created the earth in such a way that there are tectonic plates which slide and that creates earthquakes and so many people die. So we could argue both ways. So what rationality cannot tell us is the purpose of creation. It can tell us that there is design in creation, but it cannot tell us about the purpose of creation. Just like now many of us have a cell phone. Now whenever we try to evaluate design without considering the purpose, we can find fault with any design. If I take a mobile, and now a mobile is useful for sending some small messages, but if I decide that my next book I am going to type on a mobile, and then I start typing and I start cursing the designer, what a stupid design, it's such a small keypad and I can't type words properly also, and you know there is no dictionary inbuilt in it, and there is no spell check, there is no word count, and it's just stupid design. The designer of a mobile is useless. The mobile designer comes to know, he says, my dear friend, the mobile is designed for another purpose. It is for communication. Her typing is a secondary purpose. Isn't it? So whenever we have to look at evaluate a design, we have to evaluate the design keeping the purpose in mind. So rational theology doesn't tell us about the purpose of creation. By our reasoning, if we say, this was the problem with historically with Christianity, which I will come to later if we get time for the seminar. Now the Christian idea is that by the graces of Jesus, this world will become a very wonderful place. God will convert this world will become the kingdom of God by the second coming of Jesus, and we'll all live happily forever. But nobody is going to live happily forever over here. So because the Christian theologians try to show how good this world is, how good this world is. Darwin and others said, yeah, how bad this world is. So, and when their arguments triumphed, then actually Darwin's theory never had much scientific evidence. But it triumphed because it supported the intellectual climate of its times. The intellectual climate of its times was against Christianity. And Darwin's theory became a convenient excuse to overthrow the Christian stranglehold on the intellect of the European intellectuals. So anyway, the point here is that what is the purpose of this world? So if we think this world is such a nice place, oh, so comfortable, so nice, God is so kind, it has provided so many things to us, then we'll find, oh, God is not so kind. There's so many problems. So we have to understand what is the purpose of this world. The purpose of this world is not to serve as a comfortable and happy place for us. The purpose of this world is as a transitional place for us to live, purify ourselves and return back to God. So basically the theists, they argue there is so much design in this world, and the atheists argue there is so much suffering in this world, and the atheists argue because there is so much design there must be God, and the atheists argue because there is so much suffering, there cannot be God. But both of these people are arguing without arguing about the design without considering the purpose of the design. So, do we see any place in this world where there is design and there is suffering together? Yes, there is a prison, isn't it? In a prison, everything is designed. Okay, this is your bunker and you will get food from here. This is your job. You go here, you do this, you do that. Everything is designed. But is there suffering? Yes, there is suffering also. So, design and suffering are not incompatible. Now, a prison is meant to be a transition place, not a permanent place. So, spiritual truths are ultimately inconceivable. But to help us grasp them a little bit, material examples are given. and no material example can fully explain the spiritual truth. So the prison analogy helps to understand that we have made some wrong choices because of which we are currently here in this material world, which is like a jail to reform us. But the prison example in itself does not convey God's compassion. Another example of where there is design and there is suffering together is hospital. In a hospital, it's precise design. You know, you can have MRI, you can have an X-ray, and all the instruments are perfectly designed, practically speaking. But still, everybody is suffering there. So, this world is like a hospital, and God is a doctor. In both these analogies, prison and hospital, what is the common point? Both the prison and the hospital are not homes. They are transition places for preparations to go back home. So like that, this world is a transition place, a preparation to go back home. So, how do we know about the nature of God? That was your original question. We can know it not through rational theology, but through revelational theology. That's why God has given us scriptures. And when we study the scripture like Bhagavad Gita, we study Srimad Bhagavatam, from there we understand the nature of God. And there also you can do an experiment. Okay, it says that. Now, if we approach God with love and devotion, God reciprocates. By that reciprocation, we feel His presence in our heart as a security, as a satisfaction, as a solace, as strength, and we start experiencing that. So, that's how even these principles are scientific in the sense that there is systematic application and there is a reciprocation. But it's a science of a different nature. It's a science of consciousness. Science of internal purification and transformation. Okay? I'll summarize the answer quickly. I said that, yes, we can understand about God's nature, through material nature, to some extent. We can see God's design, but we'll also see suffering. Therefore, to evaluate design, we have to understand the purpose of design. A mobile is used not for writing book, but for communication. Similarly, this world is not meant to be a comfortable and happy residence place. It is meant to be a transition place of preparation, like a hospital or like a prison. And this ultimate purpose of creation and the purpose of God, the personality of God, that we cannot understand through logic and rationality alone. We have to understand through revelation. That's why the scriptures are there, from which we can know God's nature. Okay, any other questions? Yes, please. Right behind.
They are suffering, still they continue in the same path. They don't say that, okay, this method is wrong, so we should try another method.
Who cannot say that they are wrong?
Actually, any Western philosophy or any advancement, they say that, okay, this is the way and we should carry in this way. But they don't say that, okay, there should be something wrong and we should revert back to something else. Why don't this?
Okay, the question is, even when people see that there is suffering, why don't they ask foundational questions? What is wrong? That is because of the stubborn desire to somehow try to enjoy this world. So when we want to enjoy this world, we can't see the facts. You know, once an anti-alcohol campaigner decided to graphically demonstrate the dangers of alcohol in a demonstration during his lecture. So, what did he do? He gave a lecture about the dangers, health hazards of alcohol, and then he had a transparent beaker containing alcohol. Then he had a small insect which he had put in a small box, and he opened the box, flung the insect inside the alcohol beaker. He flung it into the beaker. What happened? It fluttered, and within a few moments, the insect died. And he looked at all the alcoholics who were assembled. So, what do you learn from this experiment? And all of their heads went down. So, one alcoholic was looking very cheerful. He raised. What do you learn? He says, when we drink alcohol, all the germs and worms in our stomach will die. So, you know, we don't see. We see with our eyes what we want to see with our mind. Our desires determine our vision. So many of you know about Stephen Hawking. You know, he's considered to be a brilliant scientist, and despite all his physical deformities, the determination to do scientific research which he has is remarkable. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, so he goes around and he gives many talks. So one of the themes of his talks is how dangerous this world is. You know, he talks about how dangerous, you know, that an earthquake may come, a tsunami may come, a tornado may come, a meteor may come and hit us, or there will be nuclear holocaust. And now, you know, if you hear his lecture, you will think, my God, he's talking ma dukkhale vishashvatam. This world is a place of misery. But what is the solution, you know? He says the governments of the world should unite to increase the funds for space research so that before this world is destroyed, we can transport ourselves to some other planet. Now, you know, it's a good logic in one sense. But actually, the problems of the earth are not created by the earth. They are created by the residents of the earth. Isn't it? So, if we go to some other planet, it is our own mentality because of which certain karmic reactions come. So, we will bring the problems there. So, what happens is that Pashyan Apina Pashyati, Bhagavad Gita says, you know, one sees but one does not see. So, yes, you can see that there is so much suffering in this world, so much uncertainty. But the solution is not to go to the spiritual world. Solutions to use the science and technology to try to create a better paradise over here, a technological paradise, which doesn't work. So, ultimately, it's our desires. And if we don't change our desires, then we will not be able to see the reality. So, it's not that, what is that, there's an American joker, he would say, you know, that I have already made up my mind, don't confuse me with the facts. I have already made up my mind. Don't confuse me with the facts. Well, then how did you make up your mind? Isn't it? That means I have made up my mind independent of the facts. So I have my opinions independent of the facts. I don't care for the facts. So unfortunately, sometimes it becomes like that. So there are intelligent people who recognize part of the truth. But unfortunately, if they don't come in contact with proper understanding of spirituality, then this actually now... Stephen Hawking's aspiration is laudable in the sense that he recognizes the danger of this world and he recognizes the need for a more lasting shelter. But the direction in which he wants to go is regrettable because he has not come across proper spiritual understanding. So he is thinking of another material solution only, which will not work. Einstein himself said that problems cannot be solved at the same level of consciousness that created them. You had a question? Yeah, please. Okay, you have the mic, you can ask first. Then you can go there. You can let us know when we should stop. Yeah, okay.
Actually, I have a very illogical and random doubt. Pardon for that. Really, I think science is incomplete and that is accepted. But then people, materialistic people, they know only about materialism. They don't know about spirituality. So they believe in materialism and they live by it. If you come to devotees, they have... spirituality as well as materialism. Spirituality is a higher dimension science, so it explains the things in a better way. So, devotees believe in spirituality. Guruji, what's the guarantee that there is nothing beyond spirituality? It might be there might be something beyond spirituality which we don't know, and something more than what is the written, which has not been accepted.
It's an interesting question. Okay, we see study materialism and we feel that there is something spirituality beyond materialism. But there could be something beyond spirituality also. So yes, now it's certainly theoretically possible, but you have to understand the definition of spirituality and the definition of the basis of spirituality. That is God. Now God is not just some entity which is there on the altar that we worship. Yeah, that is God, but there is a definition of God. The definition of God is sarva karana karanam. The cause of all causes. So because God is the cause of all causes, by definition, there is nothing beyond God. Mattaha parataram nanya kinchita sati dhananjaya. The 7th chapter, 7th verse, Lord Krishna says, there is no truth beyond me or higher than me. So now, we may say, how do we know that? Yeah, that's a valid question. But the point is, every subject begins with certain definitions. So, you can go backward. Okay, this is beyond this, this is beyond this, this is beyond this. This tracing backwards, wherever that stops, that point is God. That point is God. So, that means by definition, there cannot be anything beyond spirituality. Now, by definition, science doesn't say whether there is anything beyond science or not. All that it says is that this is what we can study and we can explain things within this realm. Now, as you rightly said, spirituality is not just about spirituality. Spirituality includes materialism also in it. How is that? Now, most people are materialistic and they want to see material benefits. Now, actually people are experiencing material benefits of spirituality. Now, yoga, there are more Americans who practice yoga than Indians. One out of every 10 Americans is a registered yoga practitioner. Why? Because they are experiencing material benefits. It's a great way to have a workout, it's a great way to keep fit. Not only that, meditation. Mantra meditation is the best form of meditation, but there are various forms of meditation. And they are bringing tangible benefits. You know, stress, such a big problem. Anger is such a big problem. We go to any scientific laboratory in the world, go to any scientist, go to any doctor. Is there any medicine by which I can cure anger? I'm feeling very angry, I'm very short-tempered. Please give me medicine to cure short. There's no medicine like that. When people in a mental asylum become angry, at the best what they can do is, they can just give them some sleeping pill. Just now today the news is there that in one jail in North India, in the jail, a doctor had come to treat some of the prisoners and the prisoner attacked the doctor only and killed him. So, you know, the prisoners, they are in jail and they are suffering, but still they can't control their anger. So that means anger is a materially perceivable evil. It brings evil effects. But materially there is no solution to it. But spirituality, try chanting Hare Krishna. Yes, even if somebody chants Hare Krishna for 3 months, we'll find that his anger will come under controllable limits. If not, go away completely. So it's not that spirituality is about some distant realm. Spirituality by definition is the foundation of all other realms. But also along with that, spirituality will bring us tangible benefits in this world. And that's how, by seeing those benefits, so, you know, our faith in spirituality comes in two ways. One is by the theoretical understanding. It gives us clear explanation of life, the way it is. And also it gives us tangible, verifiable benefits. So, there was philosopher, I think it was, Alfred Whitehead, he said that science specializes in providing major benefits for our minor needs. It's a very insightful thing. Major benefits for our minor needs. What is the minor need? Yes, you know, I sit and if I'm here, I can't see the IPL cricket match. So, okay, we can have it broadcast on the television. Well, you can say it's a need, but it's a minor need. It provides major benefits for our minor needs. But actually for our real needs. What are our real needs? Yeah, we can say food, clothing, shelter. Does science provide that? Well, not really. You see, most of science's progress is in luxuries. Luxuries. You know, the cars have become faster, the mobiles have become faster, the laptops have become better, the internet has become faster. But by the cars, by the mobiles, by the internet, how many hungry people have been fed? So science, especially the way it is utilized through technology, provides luxuries. But often the provision of luxuries, it takes away necessities. How many people in the world can afford a car? Maybe 1%? 2%? At the most 10%. Not more than 10% in this world. Of course, third world is there. People are still poor. But when a car travels on the road and it pollutes the atmosphere, how many people suffer because of that? Everyone. So the technology as it exists, it provides benefits for a few, but often it creates problems for all. So science cannot actually benefit us at our foundational needs. And we're not even talking about our spiritual needs. We're talking about food, clothing, shelter. Has science really improved that? Not really. Then take it more foundational needs, peace of mind, self-discipline, freedom from anger. Can science provide that? It can't. So science cannot provide our real deep needs. Okay? You had a question? Yeah.
I want to ask a related one.
Yeah, quickly. Last question. I can keep your question, we'll discuss it tomorrow. Yes, please.
Prabhu, actually, I wanted to know that, I do accept that God is final, final after tracing back everything, we finally reach back to God. But what I wanted to ask is that, wouldn't God reveal only to us that we need to go back to Godhead? Can't there be some things that can be beyond, which we actually don't need to go back to Godhead?
Can you repeat the question?
Prabhuji, I wanted to know that, wouldn't God only reveal to us through the scriptures that the things that we need only to go back to Godhead? Can't there be things that are beyond the necessities for us to go back to Godhead that God may not have revealed because we don't need those things to go back to Godhead?
If I understand right, your question is that are there things beyond what has been revealed in the scripture and they may not be revealed there because they're not necessary for going back to Godhead? Yeah. Now, originally the word Veda means knowledge. So, in the word Veda, all knowledge is included. But the Vedas as they exist today, they are a body of literature and they contain certain knowledge. So now, many of the advances that we have in science are to some extent anticipated, if not directly given, in the Vedas. Now, what we call Pythagoras' theorem was already stated in the Shulba Sutra as the Baudhayan Sutra. So, like that, there are many things which are mentioned. But it is possible that there may be certain things which are not given in the scripture because they are not absolutely essential for us to go back to God. In fact, that was the next slide which I was going to show. There are three categories of knowledge. Paravidya, aparavidya and avidya. We'll discuss tomorrow. So, the Vedas originally are a comprehensive body of knowledge which provide for our material and spiritual needs. So when Ravana was going in his Pushpak Viman, you know, the Pushpak Viman was not followed by a tail of smoke behind it. It was not creating any pollution. So, that means there was some other technology by which the airplane was flying, just as the birds fly without creating a tail of smoke. Now we have implemented flying, but in a different way which creates pollution. So this specific way, of course there is Vimana Shastra which mentions this also, but at this point I am telling is there are subtler ways of achieving the same results which technology provides. So all the benefits that technology is providing are also there in the Vedic culture. But the same mechanisms may not be used because those mechanisms which we are using are often short-sighted and counterproductive. Okay, is this clear? So if you have any other questions, you can note them down, we'll discuss them tomorrow. And thank you very much for your thoughtful hearing and your intelligent questions. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Announcements? Give them up.
Hare Krishna. A few announcements. So this is a request to all of us from our serving team of devotees. After taking prasad, it is a humble request that all of us, you know, we can keep our plates and glasses in the allotted place. Next to temple hall, if we go out, we'll see a big aluminium box. That's where we should keep our plates, not, you know, in and around the well here or in our voice premises. Same thing with glasses. Now we'll be having prasadam. Serving will be in both the places, temple.